Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
Every fallen family's feeling is the same, is that their loved ones are going to be forgotten. So that's our mission, is that they not be.
The sacrifices our ancestors made, they who marched away, not for a moment, not for a day, away, away forever.
I will give my all to you. May God bless America. And may God protect our troops.
Now, World War I brought about significant social change, not least the introduction of jazz to Europe.
We won France by playing music which was ours and not a pale imitation of others.
The real patriotism is when you're black in America and you fought for a nation even though that nation did not fight for you. That's real patriotism.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright, and happy Memorial Day, everybody. And since it's Memorial Day weekend, we're going to spend this show in a remembrance of our own. We're going to look back at World War I and a remarkable group of soldiers who made history on several fronts, in the war itself, in the story of Black people in America, and in the history of American music. And to set the stage for that, we've invited one of our colleagues at WNYC who gave us this idea in the first place and who helped produce the show you're about to hear. Joe Young is not just a proud servant of public radio, he's also a proud member of the U.S. Army Reserves. And specifically, he's an executive officer in the Army Band. So he's got a unique ear for this particular story we're going to tell. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how you doing?
So can we start with just sort of like, this is a day that's been set aside for us to remember, to commemorate those we've lost. So for yourself, what are you reflecting on and remembering on a day like today?
So Memorial Day is always billed as, you know, remembering those who sacrificed their lives to give us freedom. And what does that really mean? That, like, you can comprehend that they gave their life. And that in and of itself is sad, but I have to think of it like in the tiniest details, things that you can actually feel. Mm-hmm. Like, what does it feel like to have known someone close to you all your life? You know all their little quirks, their personality, their smell, their tastes, their interests, and then that person is gone. Mm. You know what it feels like to hold their hand, to touch their shoulders, to lay next to them. And then they're gone. All those really fine details of what it means to lose somebody is what I try and think of on Memorial Day. Yes, it's important to broadly recognize that these people gave their lives to fight for the freedom we have in this country.
In service, but in service in the military.
In service of our country, absolutely. But for me, until I boil it down, that's when the empathy just like hits me at my cores.
I mean, and a lot more people can relate to that right now, I imagine, this Memorial Day after the year we've just had, and all of the people we've lost to COVID as well. So that's a beautiful thought. So what made you enlist, Joe?
Oh, I didn't know how I was going to pay for college. And I think that's true for a lot of people. Some lady walked in to my band class in high school in uniform with a clarinet. And she said, play music, we'll pay for school. And that was it. I was like,
that's all
great,
you needed to know.
There was no sense of duty or patriotism attached to my enlisting. It was strictly pay for school.
Tell us about patriotism for you, and particularly the role of music in that patriotism.
When I started playing taps, when I started rendering taps for fallen soldiers, and to see and to hear the reaction from the friends and family members. Sometimes it's just, you know, an outpouring of tears, or sometimes it's absolute silence. Mm-hmm. Hearing the silence is incredibly powerful. I've played taps for veterans who have lived a long life and just passed away from natural causes and served their country, you know, with honor, and their families they are grieving. I've also played taps for soldiers who have been killed in war, mm-hmm. who have suffered from PTSD and taken their own lives. And to be right there next to the families and friends of these fallen soldiers, oh, it hits you like a ton of bricks. And that really forms what patriotism is to me. It's not just root for America. It's like root for each other. Mm-hmm. And music, being able to pull those feelings out of people, it's I don't want to call it the best medicine, but it kind of is. It's so powerful.
You're describing these really wonderful and emotional experiences of being able to play this song for people in their time of need. But so does that mean, like, how do you end up being that person? Are you on call to come play at the graveside, or just how does this work?
So there are military buglers that are more or less on call. That is their full-time role. That's not true of every bugler, but essentially every bugler is always at the ready to leave and render taps where it's needed.
Mm. I even love the way that's put, render taps. It's not play a song, it's render taps.
And just a thing that I find really special and interesting about taps is all bugle calls, they have a specific dictated way to play them, a certain tempo, certain notations. But what is sort of an unwritten rule among military buglers is taps is one where you can be a little free with how you express it, a bit rubato, because it's not something to be executed. It's something to be expressed and shared with the family and friends of the fallen soldier.
Mm. Can you give us some of that medicine now? Can I hear you play a version of taps for us?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for that, Joe. That was really beautiful. So let's talk about that song. Where did that come from? It's probably the most well-known piece of music to come out of the military.
Yeah. So initially, the military had drums and fifes. This must sound like small piccolos that told soldiers how to move. Then the bugle came along and added to that role. It was a function. The bugle was there to tell soldiers where to move, when to go to sleep, when to wake up, when to put the fire out. And one of the bugle calls, when it was just a tool, was called Extinguish the Lights. And it was taken from a French military bugle call. And literally, it was, hey, soldiers, put the fire out. Let's go to sleep. Get your rest.
This is Revolutionary War era or Civil War era?
This is the Civil War era. And some, you know, commander along the way said, you know what, I don't like this bugle call too much. I'd like to change it. So he brought his bugler over. He hummed a tune to him, and the bugler sort of brought it to life, realized the tune, and said, great, I like that better. Let's use that as the new put the fire out tune, if you will. And not long after, there was a Union captain, John Tidball, and there was a soldier who passed away, and they were giving him a military funeral. Mm-hmm. And normally at the time, they would fire volleys, the rifles, loud gunshots. Mm-hmm. In this case, he didn't want to do that because he didn't want to give their position away to the enemy.
Right.
So he said, get the bugler and have him play taps. And that's how taps became associated with honoring fallen soldiers.
Wow.
Thank you.
Joe told us that TAPS was the first time that music in the military transitioned from being a tool, as he put it, those drums and fifes helping direct troops, to serving an emotional purpose, to being art. And as we talked about it, I told him about my own fascination with a World War I era army band. It was a jazz band from Harlem, from New York's 15th National Guard unit, which was all black. And when that unit mobilized for war, they formed a band, one that made history. Anyway, Joe said that if I'm into that story, I had to meet one of his favorite jazz artists today, a guy who is so into that band's history, he's written whole music programs about it. So, after the break, I sit down at the piano with the world-renowned composer and MacArthur genius, Jason Moran, to talk about the musical history of the most decorated fighting unit in World War I. Stay with us.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. It's Memorial Day weekend, and we are celebrating with a remembrance of one remarkable group of soldiers in World War I, an all-black regiment known popularly as the Harlem Hellfighters. This unit is notable both because of its huge role in the war itself and because of its place in the history of civil rights. And we'll get to all of that in a bit. But it's also notable because of its most famous member, James Rhys Europe, a composer and band leader who, in the course of fighting in France, both introduced Black American music to the world and revolutionized its sound. To talk about that musical history, I sat down with one of today's most celebrated composers. Jason Moran is the artistic director for jazz at the Kennedy Center and a MacArthur genius, among many other fancy things. And thanks to vaccine science, we got to meet in person and at a piano.
Cool. I want to check one thing before we... I just want to check my hand.
Please, you should. I
haven't played today.
Jason Moran is so passionate about this history that a few years ago, to mark the centennial of the end of World War I, he toured all around Europe playing a concert he created to honor James Rhys Europe and the Harlem Hellfighters. So James Rhys Europe, you have called him the Big Bang of jazz.
Yeah, I like him. I like him as the Big Bang of jazz because there's so much that he outputs in his short lifetime. Mm-hmm. That then become the strands that everybody can pick up. So Louis Armstrong picks up the strand of what it means to be a soloist. Duke Ellington picks up the strand of what it means to embody a kind of a black sonic history and then impart it to a black orchestra, kind of like making like the big band a thing about blackness. And also there's the activism model, which is James Rhys Europe trying to take care of African-American musicians off stage, you know, and the demands on the kind of equality. Those things all are the strands that we're still, you know, picking up today. And maybe the most important one is him bringing the music outside of the country. So him, by virtue of World War I, bringing the music to France and then, like, dropping this new idea on a population. Like, this is the possibility of the music.
So before he heads off to France, what was his music like pre-war? What was he playing?
Well, he was called, like, you know, the king of syncopation, you know. And what that means is there's ragtime music that exists before him that he grows up in, you know? Mm-hmm. So this is mostly people know Scott Joplin's music. Mm-hmm. And then James Rhys Europe comes along and says, okay, but we can spread it out to further than just the piano. Let's spread it out to like many, 60 people 100 people, 160 people. He kind of like keeps envisioning something larger, but also knowing that this is going to expire. There's something else that we have to tease out about how complex we are as people, and we have to seek the freedom of what we can't experience in person on this stage.
Give us a taste of that. What would the ragtime sound like, and then where is he taking it?
I'll try, right? So, you know, because for all the Joplinites, they'd be like, that's not the right notes. So Joplin is writing, like, let's say, The Entertainer. It's like... added some Thelonious Monk and stuff in there. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's just my hand is not a robot. But what James Reese Europe does is there's a song called it's like he is moving it, you know, like, and also he's writing these songs with people too. So that song was written with Chris Smith. He wrote many songs with Noble Sissle. So he's also kind of like doing this model that Duke Ellington picks up when he writes with Billy Strayhorn, showing a kind of compositional camaraderie, saying, nah, this is a shared language. I don't need just my name on it.
And he becomes the first Black jazz artist to play at Carnegie Hall too, right?
Yeah, and that's before the war, yes. Yeah. And that there are, you know, he's not alone in this, right? There are many composers, Hall John, there's many composers of that era who are trying to force this issue, a kind of a recognition about what we can demand on the stage that isn't bound into in a kind of flatness of blackface. Yeah. And he's trying to make sure that there's an understanding of this. And so his premiere is, you know, like there's this frenzy of a crowd who can't get into Carnegie Hall.
Because they don't let Black people in.
Well, no, it sold out. And Black folks was in that audience that night too, you know? So in history, we sometimes also flatten the line. Mm-hmm. Oh, Black folk couldn't do X. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Black folks were doing X, you know? So he's kind of like, I don't know. What I kind of say is... He's so famous. He's kind of like Kendrick Lamar, right? He's doing what he wants to do. And then by the time the war happens, he envisions something much larger than he's experienced in his fame already. And he says, nah, there's something else to test in this music. And he looks for it.
So he signs up for the New York's got this elite National Black Guard, a unit of the National Guard that's all Black. And so he joins as the war recruitment effort builds, and he is given the job of creating a band for the unit.
Right.
Tell us about that. What was this band supposed to be doing? I mean, part of it was recruitment, right?
Part of it is recruitment. Part of it is, you know, he initially also wants to sign up to fight. He doesn't necessarily want to go sign up to lead a band. It's that when they see that this famous musician signed up, they say, oh, you know what? We should have you lead a band. And then he gives them an astronomical number to say, well, if you want that, then it costs this much.
Really?
Yeah, and the equivalent—
I didn't know this. Yeah. He charged him.
Yes, he charged him.
You gotta get it, James Monsieur.
And it's the equivalent of $250,000 today, you know? If that's what he said it kind of like, you'll never pay that. And he went back to Noble Sissle, who was his right arm, you know, and he told Noble Sissle, I told him what it cost, you know? And then the next day, Colonel Hayward wrote and was like, hey, so we got the money from one guy, and so let's get this happening. And then there's this thing that happens, which is James Reese Europe, he starts putting this band together, and they also go play some of these songs in the neighborhood, say, look, we're here, we're gonna go, and maybe you all can join us.
Now, understand this moment in American history. It's maybe a generation since Reconstruction fell apart and the white backlash to emancipation set in. There's a hardening pseudoscience of race, this biological fiction of race, which says Black people are genetically inferior. And Black elites, they see the war as a chance to prove our excellence, to prove our right to full citizenship. And there's genuine optimism about that possibility. So people like W.E.B. Du Bois are really encouraging Black people to sign up and to fight. And James Reese Europe wants to do his part as an artist.
And it's, you know, it's that moment where we see how music, and specifically how Black music, is used to sow in ideas into a community. Ones of promise, you know, ones of regret, dread, what the blues still means in listening to it, you know, across the country. So James Reese Europe, one of the songs he plays is one of these W.C. Handy blueses, you know. And so when you go into a neighborhood and there they are and you hear that music, which is also new, revolutionary music. So it's not like, it's not old school music they're playing. They're playing like the future music. It's like Sun Ra saying, you know, come join the war.
Come join the war. Can we hear some of that? Would you, like,
let's see.
At that time, what's he, you know, if I was, I'm standing on a corner in Harlem.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and along comes them trying to get me to come join the army. What am I going to hear?
So it's like. It's like that song is a blues that keeps migrating. You know, like part of like what we learn about the blues is, or of the many things that we feel in the blues is there's always a root there, right? So that's the thing about it. It never tries to hide where home is. That's what also makes blues so confrontational to listen to, is this interrogating the home. But in that song, that blues keeps kind of like modulating, you know.
Say more about that. What do you mean? Help me understand.
So like when I think about like being from Texas, hearing the blues all when I'm growing up, hearing Lightnin' Hopkins, who's from my neighborhood, what he sets in those songs, and every blues musician has set is a reflection about home. And part of when I say home in the music sense, that's the bottom note that will always make sense no matter where the song goes. You know, and it's a revolution that happens. Like that relationship to home is quintessential to also what James Reese Europe is introducing to the community to say, I know I'm about to take all of you all back across the water, but we're going to play the music that's going to tell us where home is, you know?
That's powerful.
It is. I mean, James Reese Europe knows that the blues are an important and integral part of getting soldiers to sign up. So he takes the blues to the neighborhood, you know, and people sign up.
But the armed forces, they were not into this at all. And even those who reluctantly embraced it, they wanted to maintain the segregated post-Reconstruction society that was really still taking shape. So white leadership took every opportunity to undermine and dehumanize these black troops. So for instance, when the 369th was sent to fight alongside the French, the Americans were so nervous about the deployment that they circulated a trick communique to French light officers, written as though it was coming from their own commanders rather than from the Americans. It warned that black people were, quote, a constant menace, and that black troops should not be, quote, spoiled. We must not commend too highly the black American troops, it read, especially in the presence of Americans. I often wonder about how soldiers like those in James Reese Europe's band processed all this nastiness as they were sent off to fight in somebody else's war.
There's this one image that I love seeing. It's James Reese Europe actually standing in front of the Clef Club, his huge orchestra behind him. And he's got like this kind of crate with the American flag draped on it, on the floor, as if it's a coffin. But it's also where he stands when he conducts.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know, just in that image, like, you understand so much about what is at stake for them. And this is before the war. Mm-hmm. But he's like, nah, there's something about this that in this image, I think, encapsulates the uneasiness of what they are now committing to.
Yeah. I can never get past, when I think about that moment in that era, the deep belief of so many black people and so many of the individuals who were going to war, mm-hmm. the optimism mm-hmm. in the act that, oh, once we do this, then we'll be able to set America off on the right course. They'll start to understand that we're human beings.
Right.
And what I know from history about how naive that optimism was is heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. And so then what is the possibility that each one who signs up for this war is looking for? I always think that what we constantly are given throughout history is examples of people that despite how shitty the country is, they like, nah, but that's not my promise. And my promise sometimes live in this song, and I can't take the promises not given to me in this country as law. I have to imagine something else. Mm. So then what does it mean for soldiers to say, well, despite the country's ambivalence towards me, I'm going to show you actually what my promise is. Mm. And I'm also thinking about mostly about them on the journey back across the ocean. That's what I'm thinking about.
Right.
And there's one account. There's a couple of accounts, but one, Noble Sissel, James Reese Europe's right hand, and he talks about that ride, you know? And he talks about them having to be at the bottom of the ship with no lights on, playing these slow, soft songs for each other back across this ocean. That sends me in chills.
Yes.
So this is what they're back in the tomb again. You know, I mean, so I also wind that up in this history, you know, a possibility for people who are trying to make sure that they live up to what they have in their own minds, despite what the country says is their limitation.
But what's nice about this particular story is it's an example of the maxim that the truth will always come out. Because James Reese Europe and the 369th blew the minds of the French. And you know how throughout the 20th century, there was this kind of odd cultural romance between the French and Black Americans? How Black intellectuals and artists would leave here and go live there, and the French were sort of obsessed with their work, and jazz in particular. All that started when the 369th showed up to fight.
So they arrive, amongst the things that happens is that James Reese Europe's band is sent to tour the front, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. And that's the moment that the French are like, whoa, who is this? I don't care what them Americans said about these people. This is some other stuff.
This is, yeah.
What music were they playing then? What is it? What would the French have heard that became so overwhelming
to them? Well, the piece of music that blows their minds is the Marseillaise. So James Rhys Europe does a remix of their national anthem that when the audience is hearing it for the first time, they're like, well, what is, okay, that's nice. And then they realize, oh, this band has done a remix of our own anthem in a way that is like, how are they doing this? And so much so that they're overwhelmed that people are walking up to the instrument saying, the trumpet doesn't really do that. You know, the saxophone, this must be a trick instrument that you all are making these kinds of sounds with these instruments. And it's that kind of imagination that, you know, it's different when you have a soloist like a Louis Armstrong. Mm-hmm. But now you have like 60, 70 people kind of all like at this kind of like extreme technique that is on display with also this kind of true understanding of like, nah, this is what this music means.
It's worth noting, by the way, that this tour also marked the beginning of a tradition that persists today. The average jazz band does way more touring in Europe than it does here in the US. But the sound of that first tour with that remix of the French national anthem, it's lost to history.
No one can hear what he did with that song, right? There's just accounts of what he did with the anthem. It's kind of like, let's say, when we heard Jimi Hendrix play the anthem, you're like, okay, that's quite an imagination on the song, but also tells us what time it is, you know? So part of what James Rhys Europe had been doing for decades was teaching musicians like how to get effects out of the instrument. Even the concert at Carnegie Hall, many of the musicians didn't read those charts he had. So he taught them note by note. So what we hear is, so we're kind of like seeing like an invisible technique, a thing that's not written on the page. Mm-hmm. And when you listen to the one recording that we have from his celebration tour afterwards, you hear a kind of embouchure in the brass musicians that is so impeccable that when I play it for musicians who are playing the charts today, they're like, oh yeah, I can't really do that. And I'm like, no, but they were doing that back in 1918.
So how come you can't do it
like,
now?
You know, like, didn't we move forward, you know? And maybe what you're touching on is we're talking about a technique of our heritage. And that technique does not always exist in a conservatory, you know? And so that technique is passed down in the neighborhood. Right. And so the sounds of the neighborhood then are the things that impact the sound of how I phrase these four eighth notes. There's a certain rhythm that I feel on it because that's what my neighborhood sounds like.
Home. It gets back to that home thing.
Yeah.
A few months ago, we talked to this cultural historian, Saidiya Hartman, and she talked about Duke Ellington hearing the sounds and the shafts of the apartment buildings in Harlem, and that informed the cacophony that he would bring to his compositions.
Yeah.
That's just such a beautiful idea that this sort of bringing like the actual lived Black experience into this music that became so definitive to the Black experience.
And what do you, you know, there's something about hurdling that idea that it's worth sharing with someone else. It's worth sharing the sounds from the air shaft, you know, with an audience. Mm-hmm. It's not just this thing that just lives behind my house. Or for Howlin' Wolf, when he plays a song about the backyard dog, like, no, it's worth you hearing what a Third Ward Houston dog sounds like that's on the street at 12 o'clock midnight, you know? Like, I should share that with you. And what these soldiers are also saying is that you understand what our humanity actually is. With all of your lies that you've given us, this is where our humanity lies. And this is what we want to try to put on Front Street for you.
This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm talking with jazz pianist and composer Jason Moran about the legacy of James Rhys Europe and how Harlem's 369th Regiment changed everything about American music when they shipped out to fight in World War I. Stay with us. Hey, this is Kai. So just a quick program note here. When we started making this show back in 2016, we were just trying to bring context to that wild campaign season, and particularly the history that we all carried into it. And initially, we figured we'd stop after that election, but obviously, there was a lot more to chew on. Which is just to say, if you're new to the show, there are tons of episodes here that I hope you'll check out. We've taken snapshots of the political culture.
It's not right. I'm sorry. I feel bad for people that are, like, oppressed, and I mean oppressed. But, you know, if we got to take care of our own, too.
We've asked how power is really built in a democracy.
I don't believe that demography is destiny. I think demography is a pathway, but it takes work. And we are the first campaign in the Deep South to put in the work.
And we've just mined all kinds of history in an effort to put America on the couch, to understand how we got here as a country and where we're going. So I urge you to dig around in the archives. It is all still relevant. And, you know, if you hear something that raises new questions for you and you want us to follow up on that, hit me up. Email me at anxiety@wnyc.org and maybe we'll take you up on it. Thanks a bunch. Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright, and this is a special Memorial Day weekend edition of the United States of Anxiety. We're on break. I'm probably at the beach right now, actually, but I'm sharing a conversation re-recorded with jazz composer and pianist Jason Moran, who shares my passion for the World War I history of the 369th Regiment. Earlier in the show, we talked about the history of the song Taps, but Jason says the 369th band came up with their own way to memorialize their fellow service members.
So one of the things that we hear from Noble Sissel is that when soldiers would not return from the battlefield, they would play the song Flee Like a Bird. And it's this very somber... Like he's laying soldiers to rest, but also he's playing songs for soldiers who are unsure if they're going to return from the battlefield. Yeah. And he's got something for their souls if they don't. You know what I mean? Earlier today, I was listening to someone talk about the need for the ceremony around the dead, you know, and in current situation right now, it's been very difficult to have a ceremony for all that have passed away in the past year and a half. And so when I think about James Reese Ure playing this song, he's also acknowledging that they won't get that ceremony. That body won't get that ceremony. The family won't get it back home. So in this moment, let's alter the program to make sure that we give the ceremony to this, to our brother. And then the bridge of that song, when it kind of like migrates just for a second to something brighter, I always think that that's like really there trying to let the soul go in that moment, you know? I wish we could hear like a concert, like really what, how does he place it in order? You know what I mean? Like what song goes by the next song, right? By the next song, and then where does he want to take us? And when is the feature for the two drummers, you know?
Because these would be concerts for troops, for soldiers, and they would be, and so where would he put the mournful march? And where would he put the thing that would say, we've got this?
Yeah.
So what's an example of that? I mean, did he do work that was like, you know what, this is also freedom. We are here about freedom.
I mean, the song that kind of like was my first hook was a song that he was adapting called Russian Rag. It was called Russian Rag, right? And it's big, you know? It's like... Thank you. right? Like
massive.
It's massive. And that's the one thing is it's hard to understand now the scale of the sound. I just can't imagine it. Actually, the times I can actually imagine it is when we hear HBCU marching bands. Mm-hmm. When you hear that trombone section blasting, you know, mm-hmm. like what they're capable of doing, that's the mass of sound that we should understand that this band is playing with, a kind of a bravery that you hear. Because you have to kind of convince someone, you know, like we all...
And listen.
You know what I mean? Yeah, like, I'm going to convince you that this is a good idea.
Out here and maybe get killed.
Yeah.
And you know, and the regiment turns out to be, you know, we should point out, it's the most decorated
right.
battle regiment
yeah.
in the whole of the war.
Yeah.
And stood on the front line 191 days, longer than any other regiment in all of the American or French army.
Yeah, receiving the medal, the Croix de Guerre, you know, like from France.
From France. None from the United States.
None from the United States.
France gave 170 members of the regiment its version of a Distinguished Service Medal. And the Germans are actually the ones who dubbed them the Hellfighters because of one particularly remarkable battle. But in the United States, their service went unrecognized.
And that is like one of the many burns. This is one of them. That I think even to this day, people are still like rallying for an understanding of what the 369th really meant to the country. It's not what they meant to the war, it's what they meant to the country. The ideas that they are proposing about a kind of bravery and a kind of citizenship to a country that still is like, you know? And it's that robbery, which we still see on display daily in the country, that still worries me, you know, about how we might minimize the valor of these soldiers.
You mentioned syncopation. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that he brought into the world for the French, the syncopation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard you talk a lot about just sort of it as a metaphor for the United States. Mm. So first off, can you demonstrate what we mean by syncopation?
Right.
And then tell us like what that means to you, what it's a metaphor for.
Right, well, I'll demonstrate playing something straight. I'm going to try to, at least. I'm going to try to demonstrate playing something straight and then playing something syncopated. And I'm going to try to keep the same phrase as I do it. So this might be maybe something like this. Right, that's kind of the straight version. But like the syncopated version might be. Is getting there before the downbeat. And what I say about syncopation is it's the anticipation. America moved too slow. So the rhythm is, I'm going to have to get there sooner. Mm. It's just black folks saying, uh-uh. You know, I have to kind of give you the idea that, no, we need to move this along a little bit faster. Yeah. And then by the time Louis Armstrong arrives, like 10 years later, then we hear it in full display. He's like, yeah, no, I got what you mean, James Resherp. This is how this goes. And so we hear, like, in the 19-teens, we hear syncopation really becoming the idea of the future, which then becomes the seed of what the Harlem Renaissance becomes, too. The arts will always give us that first clue as to something that's about to happen.
Yeah, I've also heard you talk about the solo in jazz and what it means and how we misunderstand it.
Well, the power in the solo is the moment that you could say what you feel about this song right now. You like it? All right, let me hear that. You hate it? Let me hear that. You think it could sound better? All right, well, let me hear what you think. But the thing is also, this is a moment where I say black Americans are not like, you can't just walk on the street and tell us what you think about everything. I mean, you can, but there are repercussions for it.
Yeah.
From a white danger, you know, that is persistent. And in those solos, though we think they're kind of like obvious parts of kind of like jazz culture, that politically it's saying, nah, I have a lot to say. Mm. And you might not understand it either. Mm. And it's okay. So, you know, it's, and John Coltrane probably, for me, becomes maybe one of the best models of it in the 60s when he's playing a 28-minute saxophone solo. Coltrane is saying in that moment, I'm not finished.
You just have to listen. I'm not done. You know, I think of James Reese Europe and the idea of like, we're going to have a big band, you know, we're going to be big, we're going to be overwhelming. This is ambition personified at a moment in Black history and American history where Black people are saying, no, look, we're going to prove to you how great we can be.
Yes.
And then by the time you get to Coltrane, you get to the 60s, it's shut up and listen. It's an individual
it is.
Saying, you it know what, is. I need to talk to you about something.
I need to talk to you, and my ideas, they might sound abrasive, but look outside. It's abrasive to everyone in my community. You know what I mean? Like, I remember hearing some students really listen to, like, Interstellar Space by John Coltrane and say, oh, he sounds angry. But I was like, do you know what year it is?
Right.
Do you know what's happening to Black folks?
I mean, come on.
Do you know the kind of white terror that is just on display? And then so what, we're supposed to just walk into a studio and make something kind of sensitive that then disregards that this is happening out on the streets? Nah, that just is, we're incapable of doing that. And I'd say that one thing that gets pulled away from the music in conservatories is the activism model that existed in, let's say, a Max Roach, an Abby Lincoln, a Nina Simone. It's not really kind of firmly attached to the songs that we've learned to play. And that part now, you know, we must, as kind of for the future of the music, understand the sacrifice these musicians really put, you know, out publicly. And so James Reese Europe becomes like an emblem of that kind of thinking. But also he only made one record. So. Yeah.
Well, he died 3 months. What is it? 3 months after he got back from the war, he returns a hero and and an international celebrity.
Yeah.
And died.
Yeah. Yeah. He's murdered during a concert in Boston, at Mechanics Hall during the intermission, you know? And he was backstage greeting other musicians. The great singer Roland Hayes comes to visit him during the intermission, you know, like, because it's James Reese Europe. People come see that. And he's also there to do a dedication to Black soldiers the next morning in Boston, you know, for a statue. But he's stabbed by his drummer in an altercation during the intermission and stabbed in a way that he thinks, you know, I'll survive this neck wound. I think because he's seen the worst of wounds in a war, right? Yeah. He's like, no, I'll be, you know, just continue the concert and we'll meet up tomorrow. And he doesn't live through the night. You know, there's one image of Duke Ellington standing at the grave of James Reese Europe, giving flowers. I think what Ellington sees in James Reese Europe is this expansive model. It's why Duke Ellington is known. He's a great pianist. He's one of my favorite pianists. But we really know him for having an orchestra.
Right.
And one of James Reese Europe's thing was like, nah, we should have orchestras. We should have Black American orchestras, you know, playing Black music the Black way. You know, like he says that.
Ellington brings that to life.
Ellington makes it like, I got you. So there's just something about what that music means and what that story means, and that has also been quite absent in a jazz history that we, you know, I'm really trying to also be a mouthpiece for.
I asked Jason where he thinks the music's at today, more than 100 years after James Reese Europe's Big Bang, and at another moment in which there's kind of a new Black politic emerging.
I'd say one part is within jazz canon, there is an interrogation of the system itself. There's an interrogation of the kind of misogyny in it, the deletion of the female in it, you know, like these systems that also are also controlled by a white patriarchy, you know? Like now we're not only just looking at it out in that world, but like let's look at it in our jazz canon too. I think we're on the cusp of another renaissance, you know, just because history tells us this, that we've been locked up a year and a half, and there's lots of minds who have now digested this without any kind of fauna of it's all glorious. No, it just isn't. But I don't know. I mean, I put out a record earlier this year called The Sound Will Tell You, and it was, you know, made in the past year, and it was mostly slower music. It was just, I actually liked it because it actually acknowledged a darker sense of myself that I probably admitted it in doses on records before. But this one I gave over to it because I think a lot of us were in that space. But also I think for me, I love working with young musicians, trying to help empower them through a really dark time in history. And that music, though it seems inconsequential, that it actually is a vitamin that people desperately need.
Thank you so very much for this.
My pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
And happy Memorial Day.
Same. Thank you.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Candace Brown mixed the podcast version. And a special thanks to Joe Young for help producing this episode. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Carl Boisron, Emily Botine, Karen Frohman, and Christopher Wirth. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Verlyn Williams is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at @Kai_Wright. And as always, I hope you'll join us for the live show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening.
I want to play two themes for you, just so you have them.
Yes, please.
And one of them is based on a small section of this very weird song he played called Plantation Echoes. Mm. Very strange, kind of odd medley of racist songs that he put into a song called Plantation Echoes. But in the middle, there's just this gem of two bars of music, you know, that I couldn't help but obsess over. And it kind of sounds like this. I feel like he just plants it. He just slides just two bars. And it for me, like, it was like 2 a.m. listening to that. And it just like jumped out like a bud, like in springtime. Like, you're looking at this like stump. And then all of a sudden out comes this indigo. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, oh, it felt like that, you know?
And try to describe for me the indigo that you're hearing. Like, what is it about it that when it, in it made you...
When you listen to this song, it's kind of clipping along as if you're watching Birth of a Nation, you know, mm-hmm. like which happens later, right? So, but it's as if you're watching something like, why are y'all playing this? Mm-hmm. Why are you showing this? And so the song is just kind of happening. And it's like fancy, but it's like a fancy kind of idealized racism, yeah. you know, like perpetual plantation models all over the country, you know? So you hear it. It sounds like that. And then all of a sudden comes bursting through. Womp, 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 womp. And it's like, wait, what is that? And then it goes right to another song, like Dixie or some mm-hmm. weird song like that. And so, but for me, it's like, wait, what did you just plant
what
there?
What did you just plant?
And he just plants it as like any great composer. They don't even obsess about their brilliance. They're like, yeah, you know, whatever.
And what do you think he was trying to say?
I don't know.
Or is that the wrong thing to ask of a composer?
I don't know what he was trying to say, you know. But when I heard it, I was like, oh, that is the gold. And it's almost that he places it in the transition, like, which even makes it more powerful. It's kind of like the breakbeat, you know, like mm-hmm. you get producers like obsessing over records, finding some weird Ahmad Jamal record and listening to it. And then they just hear just that sliver And then Premier or Pete Rock says, I'm going to sample that for Nas. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And when that moment happens, that's what James Reese Europe also plants in that music too. It's like, nah, these can have all kinds of flavors, but then I can introduce just for a second something unbelievable and just kind of keep it moving.
I felt my chest opened. I felt like the emotion of it for me is, and maybe it's because you gave that description of what it was surrounded by, but it felt like a swagger, like a, you know what? You
yes.
know what?
Yes.
I'm free of that.
That's it. That's
I'm free of that.
That's it.
What it felt like.
And maybe that's, you know, and you help pull out the fact that maybe him slipping that in the transition. And when I talked about all those phrases and those terms about in Black music, him putting it in the transition is like, nah, that's the freedom model. Is don't just think that it's the song, but like even in that little moment to get from section to section, in that transition is actually the freedom. It's the breathability of it. It's actually what we hear when we hear Billie Holiday like 20 years later, pulling at the rhythm of those songs. Like she's showing the flexibility of the model in a way that nobody had done before. And that, you know, like that's just, and it happened for the rest, you know, in all great Black music, we hear the beauty in the transition. Yes. So anyway, I wanted to make sure I played that for you all, because that's my latest great treasure. I'm so happy about that.
You said you had two treasures. Let me hear the other one.
Well,
I'll do this again. We are your time. So you... I pay a whole lot of money to sit and do this.
So this is a song, I'm just going to play the intro to it, but this is a song called All of No Man's Land Is Ours. So he writes this song when he's in the hospital, you know. It was a song he had begun writing, because he had written songs on the battlefield, so he also has the soldiers sometimes make the sounds of the battlefield. You hear rockets, you hear charging, you hear, you know, like what the war actually sounded like they put into the songs. But he writes this kind of melody at the beginning. And it's like, right, he's like, yeah, nah, all of no man's land is ours. We're about to come.
We are coming
to push the front line, you know?
And he writes it from the hospital.
And he writes from the hospital. Yeah. And that, you know, there's something about where composers write from, you know? Are they in a nice cabin by the lake, you know? Are they in a hospital recovering from mustard gas wounds, you know? Are they in Compton, you know what I mean? Like looking outside, hearing the helicopter. Where are the composers writing from? So James Reese Europe always has something nearby to document the moment and the sound. So just hearing him play, like, that's the sound he was hearing. Yes, this is the phrase he hears first. Like that's how a song starts. And I don't know, like just for a composer to just like be that delicate in that moment, but then move it to like all no man's land is ours is, I don't know, he's unafraid to document the moment. And I think for all artists, that's the thing we battle with most is when is the appropriate moment to share or to put it down on paper and then have to like stare at it.
What do you mean?
Well, any composer, when you write the song down, it's also staring back at you. When you put the pencil to the paper or you write your first lines, Toni Morrison writes the first line of a novel, after she types it, it shows up. It comes up the line, and then also those words are staring back. So his phrases, his ideas, his mind, his image is staring back at him in that moment. It's a mirror those compositions become.
And he's got to be ready to see that.
And he's got to be ready to see it, whether he's you know, whether he is actually psychologically ready or not. But I think since he's with a group, then they can do it collectively together. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, empowers him. And I don't know if he was really, if he knew that that would be part of the major part of his legacy, but I think that was the part he was wrestling with when he signed up. Was like, okay, so I'm gonna do this? So I know I lead people and all, but every leader, every once in a while, I was like, is this the one? Yeah, yeah, you know. Okay, I'm done, y'all.
Oh, man.
Okay.
What a treasure.
Thank y'all.
Thank you so much. Patient. Thank you so much.